You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well.
So if you ever wanted to see Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon go around on a trip eating food and talking about their old movies, well, now you have four movies you can watch with that. Because this is the latest in what I assume is the equivalent to the Before series, but done with comedians.
Yeah, you know, it's actually, you know how they always say that Adam Sandler just makes movies as an excuse to, like, go to a nice place and invite all of his buddies over?
Yeah, this one, they don't even pretend.
This is that if they were like, you know, if Adam Sandler were making movies for, like, you know, sophisticated highbrow art house crowds, you know, it's like, hey, let's go on a road trip. Let's just go to all these great Michelin star restaurants. And in between, we'll just, you know, we'll record our funny improvisations. And that's the movie. Although it's not really a movie. It's a TV series first. So then condensed into a movie.
Which, again, it's the same filming model. It's just two comedians go to a place, they film like 5-6 hours of material, and then they cut it down into the best stuff, you know, just like an Adam Sandler film.
Yeah, and you know, it's really kind of charming. Now, really, we should let London speak here because we haven't introduced ourselves, and he is the one person on this review who has seen all of these films.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, I have, and honestly, I have really not that much more to add because that's you're describing it exactly as the other three movies were.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, I would say what the plot is of this movie, but that is the plot of this movie. It's just watching Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon eat food, talk about their old movies, talk about their families, and having actors impersonate the people in their lives who they love the most.
Right. And I think the hook here is that, you know, Coogan and Brydon are playing thinly fictionalized versions of themselves. They are two real life actors, if you're not aware. They're probably better known in the UK, and I don't think Brydon is known in the US as well as Steve Coogan.
No, he's more a TV personality in England compared to
Steve TV.
Brydon does a lot of game shows. Like, he'll be on like the panel discussion shows. He'll do like, you know, the like he did a Big Fat Quiz show. He did something else. It's like a show where, like, it's a game show where celebrities pretend to try to guess who's lying. Like, he does, like, stuff like that, so.
Yeah. He even jokes about that in the movie, too, that he does a lot of, like, reality TV and a lot of game show kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the tension of this because, I mean, if you've ever seen Steve Coogan, and I guarantee you, you've seen Steve Coogan in various movies, but he has a reputation in his TV shows and his films for playing characters who are pompous, self-involved pricks. And he kind of plays himself here like that's kind of what he really is in real life and kind of insecure about himself. And so there's that constant tension of like, well, you know, Steve Coogan is obviously the bigger star than Rob Brydon. And there's a great moment where he's like, you know, have you ever played a god before? And he's like, well, I was in Percy Jackson in the, he's like, well, they made more of those movies, didn't they? But they didn't ask you back. You know, there's this constant, it's these two guys who you can never really believe that they're like, they're friends, but they don't feel like best buddies. There's a constant competition, a constant sense of one-upsmanship between these two guys that I think is kind of the heart of the movie.
Yeah, which at the same time, you say they're not close friends. They must be close enough friends to do four of these movies over 10 years, you know? This is something they do on a regular interval of just meeting up, talking about their lives, and going on trips. It's become kind of a ritual for them. And honestly, it's the weird thing of watching this movie where, like we said, it's not so much a movie in the sense of like, oh, it's big plot, lots of action, lots of stuff going on. It's literally just watching them talk to each other.
Yeah.
And your mind vary depending on that. But for me, it worked pretty well on the whole. Now, London, I gotta ask though, since you've seen all four of these movies, is this pretty much exactly like the other films?
Well, this is what I find very interesting, is that it took me until this movie to notice the subtlety. Because every movie, like, cause, you know, we talked about how they're just friends in this one. it took them a long time to reach that point in the continuity of the series. Because in the first episode, Steve Coogan, he gets his job, like, oh, I can go and travel and go eat with people or eat and, you know, and write about it. He could not find anyone to do it with. So Rob Reiner was literally at the bottom of his list. So they were just acquaintances, and they kind of like had this uneasy tension. And like the you think the tension's a little bit here. No, in the first one it was way worse. And it was mostly Steve Coogan, because he was like, it was like a point where he was playing a character who felt like he was at the top of his game. You know, he should have been getting more respect and, you know, all that. And Rob Dryden, he's like, I don't care, I'm a fappy family man, everything's great for me. And it's just like the development is Steve Coogan kind of, he never really, he doesn't change too much, but he kind of mellows out, but it happens very slowly. And then Rob Dryden kind of stays the same, but his career kind of gets better. And so it's kind of a weird dynamic. It's, you think that, because normally regular screenwriting is, oh, they both, you know, inform each other. One, they kind of adapt to each other's ways, but doesn't really happen. It's kind of like they just, they went from just acquaintances to friends.
They're colleagues.
Exactly.
Professional colleagues.
And it's just, the only thing that I will say, though, you can still see that the camaraderie did become more cohesive or more comfortable. It's like I said, especially in this one, because in the first few, the snobbery of Steve Coogan, you know, he's a know-it-all. He feels like he should be better. Like even in the film, it's interesting because they have different dramatic moments, because in every movie, Steve Coogan usually has something dramatic happen to him. And like, I won't spoil it for anyone who wants to watch it, because I do recommend it. But like, it's kind of similar to happens here. It's like a kind of dramatic track for him. Rob Dryden, nothing really. It's always like, hey, everything's great. Go back to his family. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's like, did he have a character arc in this movie? Because he kind of just stayed Rob Dryden from beginning to end.
It's funny because there's a little sense.
Yeah. I mean, there was a little sense that Bryden had some tensions at home. You know, he calls the daughter and he's like, where's mom? When she went to the theater, who'd she go with? What do you mean she's not there? You know, and that is kind of where the movie kind of comes to life at times, because the structure obviously is very loose. It's very improvisational. It's just, in this movie, the conceit is that they are traveling the route of Odysseus through Greece. Mm. And along the way, they'll stop at a fancy restaurant and, you know, they'll chat. And usually, and this is the highlight of the film, you know, is where they have these sort of conversations and these competitions as to who can do the better joke or who can do the better impersonation. And if you've ever seen these, when this first movie came out, I remember that was all over YouTube and social media in those days. It was the Michael Caine competition between Steve Coogan.
Michael Caine.
Michael Caine. He's like, I won't bury another Batman. I won't do it. He's like, no, you're doing it all wrong. You know. And so watching these guys, and they're both very credible impersonations of Michael Caine. And the thing that's interesting to me about this is they obviously landed on that as like, this is our set piece, you know, this is what people want to see. You're going to get that moment where they're going to be sitting, and they never really care about the food, do they? I mean, like, they go to all the, there's like all these little bits of food porn thrown in and like some like travel log location photo, but they never really care too much about, like, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon are like, oh, this is really good. Yeah, I like it. And then they start going, have you ever noticed how Marlon Brando talks? And that's when the movie comes to life. But then they'll go and get a phone call and he's like, oh, we have bad news from home. And then it kind of veers off in that direction for a little while.
I think that's what was funny about the first one, was it seemed like the setup was, oh, it was going to be about, it was going to be like a thinly veiled travel guide movie. But
Because I think that's what the series was like.
That's my guess too. That's probably my guess, is like there's maybe more emphasis on the food. Because when I look at these movies, it's strange to see that it's a, I mean, I could tell that it could be a series, but all the plot points are there. You know, I can't imagine like anything else that it could be added, except maybe more impressions or more food. Like, I can't think of like what else it could be cut out.
Well, because, man, they did so many impressions. Clearly what you said, Marco, was exactly the case, where it's like, oh, that Michael Caine thing exploded on the internet. Let's just do more of that. Then this movie has like a third of the movie is them doing impressions of various actors. And it's funny. It's amusing. It did get a little long-winded at some point. Where I'm like, okay, I get it. Some of them are funny. Some of them are just like, okay, they're not the greatest at impersonating like Dustin Hoffman. Where it's like, yeah, reenacting Marathon Man is a funny bit.
I just love it because I've always loved that line about some oil of clove. You know, I'm like, oh, they're doing the oil of clove bit. Great. I thought I was the only one who thought that was a great. But you're right, Justin, in that they do kind of run out of steam there. But again, they don't have a net. They don't have a screenplay. I think it's just like, we're going to this particular restaurant today. You guys talk about whatever. And if you look closely enough, and in Coogan in particular, there are moments where he just laughs. Mm-hmm. And that's usually around where the take ends. And I'm thinking, he's stopping when Coogan breaks. It's like, you know, it's like when they can no longer maintain composure and keep character, that's when he's like, okay, we got it, you know? And of course, when you have two comedians who are just like desperately trying to make the other guy crack, that's kind of gold. This is a really charming kind of like trip with these guys. Like, but you also realize that, like I said before, they sometimes go off, they take a phone call, and they have to talk to an agent, they have to talk to a family member, something's happening back home, and they rarely share that with one another. That's what I find interesting, and London, I assume that's true in the previous films in the series, too, because it seems like they're colleagues to a degree, maybe uncomfortable friends, but they're not confidants.
No, like I said, that's what it took a long time to get to the point where we're in a movie. Like, this is the most comfortable these characters have ever been. You know, like I said, I don't know about the actors. I feel like, you know, the way Marco, you brought up a good point that Coogan laughs. I feel like they're really friends in real life. Like, they're pretty close. And Justin made a good point, too. This has been 10 years they've been doing this, so they have to have been. But in the series, like I said, the characters, in the first one, Coogan kind of hated Brighton. This is like, because he hated the fact that like he had to deal with them, and he felt like he was kind of like a hack comedian. He's like, I could do impressions too, but I didn't just do my whole career off of him. I'm a real actor. I'm a real thespian, you know. And then Brighton's like, what are you talking about? I have family, kids. I'm doing, life is great. Who cares? And so, and like, the whole series has been that. And then, like I said.
Which is another thing in this movie where he's like, you know, I don't go by comedian anymore. I'm now considered a serious actor. You know, and he starts bringing up Stan and Ollie and Green, both of which, oddly enough, I have reviewed and liked both. But one of the highlights for me in this film is when they meet an actor, again, played by the real person. Mm-hmm. Early on in the movie, they bump into one of the people who was in Greed, the previous Michael Winterbottom, Steve Coogan collaboration.
Oh, so that's what they're referring to. I didn't know.
That's what they're referring to. Yeah, because in that movie, Steve Coogan is playing a thinly veiled persona of a real-life British businessman, tycoon, who's just this obnoxious, horrible person, and he throws this huge party to kind of help resuscitate his image, but then it's overrun by like these refugees who are like coming up on his private beach, you know, and he's like, can we just get these Syrian refugees out of the way? But apparently one of the actors was a real Syrian refugee, and he was brought into the movie, and here he plays himself, and he's like, hey, remember me? And you know, you can see Steve Coogan, at least the character of Steve Coogan, trying to go, oh fuck, I know I made a movie with this guy, but I can't remember his name. And he's like would you like to come and see the would you like to come visit the center or the camp? Oh, yeah. The refugee camp, and you could see Coogan and Brighton having that sort of liberal guilt of like, oh my god, I want to support the refugees, but I don't really want to go to a refugee camp.
I didn't sign up to do that. I kind of signed up to go on a trip and eat food and talk.
Yeah, you know, and again, that's the kind of, I want to say, gentle cringe humor that is throughout this, because it is so much about these two guys who on the surface aren't really likable, yet feel human in their foibles and their pettiness and their, you know, just even when they're like competing for the attentions of like a very cute waitress. And again, because it's 10 years of time that has taken place, they're like, now they're talking about mortality and like, hey, you know, I bet you you know, well, that woman said I was very nice. And she's like, oh, she's just being nice to you. And then they start talking like, I bet you I could swim across that part of the channel. And it's just these two guys who are just trying to, like, outdo one another. And the kind of trap that happens when you fall into that kind of relationship, which probably a lot of males do.
Yeah, yeah. No, but I, you know, I generally enjoyed this movie, just discussing all those points. I think that because it's such a loose structure and it's such a unwieldy film, because it is just, I mean, because this actually is an adaptation of the TV shows they shot for the new season of this, or I guess they're all the same season. It's hard to tell with British television, but I have to wonder what else is added that they took away from the television version. But it just feels like you said, there's those weird moments you could tell when the cuts would be for either a different episode or a different, like, bit that they did. Because anytime that they run out of material for a certain gag, they just cut to somebody preparing food and then just start the whole new scene.
Yeah. They got a lot of great B-roll to use.
Oh, yeah. They got lots of B-roll. And that's fine. I just felt like at one point where I'm like, you know, I'm not paying too hard attention to this film, but I'm not disliking it. It's funny. It's charming. I don't have to think too hard about it, but I still enjoyed what I've seen about it. So I'll just segue that to final thoughts, unless you guys had another point to make with that.
No, that works for me, sir.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I enjoyed this. I do feel like I want to go back and watch some of the early films. Like, especially, I know, there's always the famous bits from the first one, like the Michael Caine impressions and that stuff. Though, it's not one that I have to say, oh, I need to rush out and see this. I'm going to give this 7 out of 10 BAFTAs that... All right. Why don't you go ahead, Marco?
This is, like I was saying, London is the veteran here when it comes to this series. This is my first experience watching it. I've heard about it for a long time. I've always wanted to check it out. I've only seen clips on YouTube. But I like these two actors. They're very funny. They do have some kind of weird chemistry together. Yet there is that tension that underlines their relationship the whole way through. And I kept thinking, this kind of feels like me and like my buddies who would go on trips and we would just like talk shit the whole time. But I realized that there wasn't that warmth there that I would have in real life with these friends. And that's when I realized, and London helped me figure this out as we were talking it through. I was like, they're not confidants. They talk about things and they're constantly competing with one another and finding ways to undermine the other actor. But yeah, you never feel like once they get on the phone and they wander off to go talk about something, they come back and it's never like, what's happening? Hey, who'd you talk to? Who's, you know, and I realized that was when I, you know, that it wasn't a relationship that is not based on anything beyond like, well, we have to make this thing work together as a film. And yet I enjoyed it immensely. I'm very interested to see the actual series because they might get to actually talk about some of this beautiful food porn that we briefly glimpse but never actually get to see.
Yeah, most of the food is even in close-ups at this
point. I'm thinking that's all the stuff that's cut out. You know, it's like somebody comes, it's like, oh, you'll be having this today with ground espresso crumbs or whatever. And then they like, oh, that sounds lovely. And that's it. And then he's like, you know, and then they start doing the impersonations bit. I wanted more of that, and right now it's not possible for me to see the series through streaming services that I'm aware of. But believe me, when I get a chance, I'm going to look it up. I give this 7 out of 10 really cute waitresses that are way too young for you and way too out of your league.
And are definitely not Nazis.
And definitely are not Nazis, yes. Not all Germans are Nazis, Justin.
Well, London being the veteran here, you get the final say on this one.
Okay, but that waitress wasn't too young for me. So,
I'm sitting here going, actually, she is too young for me. God damn it.
I'm a married man. I have no claim on this.
I turn 29 soon. I'm not that old. Okay. So. All right. I'm going to... Like I said, I've seen all of them, but I'm parodying a lot of what you guys are saying because that's kind of what the series has been. It's been a flighty, fun, charming set of films that really does lead to curiosity about what the show is like. And what I said, I think was interesting is that throughout the series, there has been development, but it's been very slow development. And I think it just ties back into it being a slice of life type of story, because it just, it feels so real. Like, because it feels like if two acquaintances had to keep doing this project over and over, and they never really communicate with each other outside of this project, and but every couple of years they have to get together and do this, it seems like this would be the relationship that they would have. They'll never become confidants, never become good friends. They'll just become maybe just friends. And I think that's what they address pretty well. And one of the things I want to bring up, I think that there's an interesting meta quality to it that's on different levels. Like, it's not just on the writing, but just on the acting and performance wise. Coogan, throughout the series, he has the most dramatic moments, and it kind of informs, it's like in real life how he likes to stretch himself and go more for the darker kind of a deeper substantive type of performance and roles, while Rob Dryden, he just does the same. He just has the same way. He's that same charming guy with his family and everything else. Even he does have actually a couple of dramatic moments throughout the series, but it never really elevates to what Coogan does. So I just think that's an interesting interesting to do as well. The only thing is, I think this, while they have, it seems like their relationship is probably the most comfortable, I feel like it's a little bit, it's the weakest of the series, because the other ones, the impressions never got kind of tedious, as Justin, you were saying, and they did actually at some points, the drama just seemed more honest. And okay, I'm not gonna spoil anything, but the one before this one, that was a really big moment at the end, and I was kind of surprised this movie happened. And we might talk about it afterwards, but I won't, because I don't want to, I'm not gonna spoil it, but because yeah. I do recommend it as a series. So I just think, but like I said, I think that's kind of, but every movie ended that way. So I think I've said my piece. So I'm always gonna say, I'm going to give this 7.5 sponsored silences for charity out of 10.
And by the way, I should add, because again, you've got 4 TV series. I don't know how many episodes. I imagine they're 30-minute episodes.
There's about 20 from what I see.
Yeah.
There's about 20 I see here, yeah.
And then 4 movies that are condensed, presumably using a lot of the same footage, but with this amount of footage, you know, who knows? You might be seeing stuff that weren't in the, that wasn't in the series. So you got 4 seasons of television. You've got 4 movies in the series. And at least now, according to Michael Winterbottom, a very prolific director, said that this is the last one. And it's interesting listening to London talking about the progression of it and not having seen those, but London, does this feel like the end of the series? Does this feel like a fitting, like, okay, this is the obvious place for them to stop? Or is it just 3 dudes are like, we've been doing this for a decade, we're done now?
Honestly, I thought the last one was going to be the final one, because it ends in a certain way, which they honestly don't discuss. They kind of hint at in this movie, but it's like a joke. But something really dark happens in the last one, which is like, oh, this is it. This is interesting. So honestly, the last one had more finality than this one.
That is weird. And who knows? Maybe in 10 years, maybe they should do this like Michael Apted's 7-Up series, where it's like, you know, every few years. Because I imagine, I was looking, I actually have on my screen the poster for the first film, The Trip, and looking at, you know, these guys, I'm like, you know, Coogan has long hair. They're both obviously younger. And in that one decade, they've both aged. Mm-hmm. And it would be really interesting to go, yeah, why don't we just meet with these guys like every 5 to 10 years and kind of take stock, obviously done in a fictionalized context. But yeah, it's interesting because you rarely get to see actors grow with playing the same characters, and they're playing themselves. Mm-hmm. But if this is the last, then, you know, that just makes watching the earlier installments all the more bittersweet, because while I didn't give it a great rating, I thought it was good, but this really makes me want to go back and dig into the previous installments.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And that's funny you were saying that's the last one, because the ending, I'm like, there has to be something else that happens after what happens at the end of this film. But, you know, it also reminds me, too, that seeing movies like this remind me why I like Steve Coogan. Because there's that period of time when he was trying to do American comedies, and then they were all freaking terrible. You have to find those few films like Philomena and this film. You're like, oh yeah, he's actually a really good actor if he actually gave himself a chance to do something good with the material.
Mm-hmm. You know? He's wonderful in Stan and Ollie.
He's
lovely in that. I mean, John C. Reilly, I think in particular, is the best part of that movie. But yeah, to see Coogan as, you know, Stan Laurel is wonderful. I'm like, yeah, I could see why he's like kind of annoyed that people keep thinking of him as a comedian. And he's like, you know, I'm a distinguished actor now. I don't go to that anymore.
I'm not just Alan Partridge.
That's right. I'm not that dick. And yet he's been playing this same dumbass version of himself for a decade now in this series. And it kind of reminded me of all things, and I know we're going long, but have you ever seen Jim Jarmusch's Coffee and Cigarettes?
Yes.
Which is just a bunch of vignettes of just Jim Jarmusch, you know, bringing it, not unlike this movie, bringing in different famous people and go, hey, just sit in a room and talk and let's see what happens. And there's a great one where Coogan, this is like late 90s, early 90s, you know, he shot it over many years.
It was like early 2000s, I think.
Oh, okay, because he shot it for like over 10 years, just whenever he had time. I think there's segments that go back to the 90s. But yeah, in the Coogan episode, he's just arrived in Hollywood. He's trying to get work. You know, he's really full of himself. And he's playing that same Steve Coogan douchebag that he always plays. And he's played himself. And he gets invited to Alfred Molina's house. And it turns out Alfred Molina is like lovely. He's very sweet. And he's like, hey. And then drops this surprise on. He's like, I found out we're cousins. We're related. And I think it would be great. You know, we should get to know one another. And, you know, it's, we should hang out. And, you know, family's important. And he's like, can I get your phone number? And Steve Coo is like, can we say I did and not? You know, he's like, he just doesn't want to do it. And then, of course, right at that moment, you know, like, Alfred Molina gets a phone call and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, it's very important. You know, and it's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm talking to Spike Lee. Or he wants me to work on a picture. And he's like, oh, you're working with Spike? You know, well, you know, I can give you my phone number now. And that idea of that an actor from so early in his career would make a point of portraying himself as this horrible, terrible person. I'm kind of curious if Steve Coogan is really this horrible a person in life. He can't be. Surely he can't. Surely it's a joke.
They even joke about that in the film at one point, too. So they're like, look, we know the persona we've created for ourselves, kind of thing.
Yeah.